It's here and now. In a moment, two voices from the South on what the Democratic presidential hopefuls need to say tonight in South Carolina. Hint, don't bring up gun control despite the horror of Virginia Tech. But first, the U.S. commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus, said today that there are two clocks ticking, a slow-moving Iraq clock and a faster one in Washington. Here's more from Petraeus in a briefing to reporters.
The situation in Iraq is, in sum, exceedingly complex and very tough. Success will take continued commitment, perseverance, and sacrifice.
Well, on the American clock, the U.S. Senate is debating a supplemental spending bill that will fund the Iraq war but includes a timetable for troop withdrawal. The bill cleared the House last night with two Republicans joining the Democrats. The president has vowed to veto the bill as soon as it lands on his desk, which may happen next Tuesday, the fourth anniversary of the president's mission accomplished speech. We turn now to Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. And the Senate, as we said, is debating, Rick. Anything jumping out at you?
No, it's been sort of a long, predictable line so far. Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, the independent Democrat who was obviously kicked out of his party basically because of his support for the war in last year's primary, gave a pretty impassioned speech a few minutes ago where he talked about this as being a disaster for the U.S. mission if a timeline for withdrawal were set. But basically, this is falling mostly along party lines. Mr. Lieberman accepted. We're expecting a pretty close vote, but Democrats to prevail as they did a few weeks ago.
Right. Well, the House vote was a party line as well. 12 Democrats voted against. Two Republicans, as we said, broke ranks to vote with the Democratic majority. The original House bill was binding. The Senate's original bill was not. What's the compromise bill that's being debated, and what are the debating points, if any?
Well, it's sort of a hybrid, maybe a little bit closer to the Senate bill. There is a binding date for initial withdrawal of October 1st, and then a goal for total withdrawal by next April. But there are all sorts of ways the president can get around that and waive the requirements, including some requirements on troop readiness and training for troops before they go over to Iraq. And so it was expected there to be something that the president could potentially support, although he's made very clear that he wouldn't support anything that has any kind of binding language. So it's going to be a veto. We'll see the veto next week and be back here in Congress as they try to figure out the next step.
All right. Well, General Petraeus today pulled no punches in his briefing for reporters. He said this is the most complex and challenging war he's ever seen. Beyond the debate over the bill, what other message was he sending about the war?
Well, one thing I found interesting about the briefing was the way he talked about al-Qaeda as a growing threat and saying that the number of sectarian attacks are down, but actually the number of al-Qaeda attacks is up. And that really fits with the political message we've heard from the White House, that Iraq is the central front in the war on terror. And bringing al-Qaeda into the equation and talking about them as being the major threat now to the security situation, I think recasts the situation in Iraq slightly. It's now no longer between Sunni and Shiites and about political reconciliation. It's about terrorists who are trying to do harm to U.S. interests and to Iraqis who are trying to pacify the country.
But interesting, just to be clear, doesn't the bill that's being debated include a provision for troops being able to stay, not to fight the sectarian battles, but to do just that, to fight terrorist networks?
That's exactly right. And even the most robust proposals for withdrawal have made those sort of exceptions in there, that there would be a big troop presence in Iraq and around elsewhere in the region to do anti-terror efforts. And something that's been part of the Democratic message all along is that we need to refocus out of Iraq to get more focused on the war on terror in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere, and that we're being bogged down by babysitting the Civil War, essentially. That is an interesting point. And if it really comes to a confrontation between the White House and Congress, the president could be saying, well, they're there fighting terrorists. They're not there trying to combat an insurgency or babysitting a civil war.
Petraeus also said there would be a comprehensive assessment of the progress in Iraq next September. We just want to ask you before we let you go, because tonight is the big Democratic presidential hopeful debate in South Carolina. At least three senators are expected to be in South Carolina tonight. And as we know, Republican John McCain formally declared his presidency yesterday. Are they all there for the vote today?
The Democrats who are running for president are all expected to be here today. Senator Dodd and Biden, Senator Edwards and Senator Obama and Senator Clinton. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's one reason that we'll see the vote pretty shortly, early this afternoon, is so that all of them can catch their planes down to South Carolina.
But we understand McCain chose not to go today. He doesn't feel that it's a worthwhile vote since it's going to be vetoed.
That's right. He's missed, I think, more votes than any of the other presidential contenders so far. And his argument has been on votes that my vote will actually matter, right, that I could be the deciding vote. I'll be there and happily represent my state.
Rick
but
Klein.
On votes that are foregone conclusions, there's no reason.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Well, presidential debate season does kick off tonight as the eight declared Democratic candidates take part in their first face-to-face televised debate. Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Christopher Dodd, John Edwards, former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel, Dennis Kucinich, Barack Obama, and Bill Richardson will all try to score points in 90 minutes. The debate comes as a poll in today's Wall Street Journal shows the first-term Senator Obama has pulled within 5 points of Senator Clinton. Well, joining us first from South Carolina is Aaron Gould Scheinen. He covers politics for the state newspaper. Aaron, South Carolina has elected Republicans, you know, for 3 decades. So remind us, who are the candidates trying to reach tonight?
Well, the general election electorate is still extremely Republican. We haven't voted for a Democratic president in South Carolina since 1976 with Jimmy Carter. But the candidates tonight in Orangeburg are going to be going after about 300,000 Democratic primary voters. And what makes the state important in the national sense in January 2008 is the fact that about 50% of those expected votes will be cast by African Americans, the most diverse early primary state in the country. So on one hand, the candidates need to be reaching out to those black voters who are very involved and very motivated and want to hear what the candidates have to say, and thus far have been fairly open to a lot of candidates. But they also have to attract the white Democrats in South Carolina who would tend to be more conservative than most white Democrats in other states.
Right. And as you mentioned, South Carolina will be third in the primaries, most likely holding a solo primary on January 29th following New Hampshire and Iowa. Let's talk about race, because the last time it was an issue in the state, there were some controversies. One black state senator said that nominating Obama would be a disaster because whites nationally wouldn't vote for him. Uproar there. Another endorsed Clinton, and it turned out he had a contract with her campaign. So tell me further how race might resonate in this debate tonight.
Sure. Race is going to be is an overarching issue in just about everything that happens in South Carolina. The Confederate flag is still flying on the State House, and the debate is being held at South Carolina State University, which is a historically black college university there in Orangeburg.
In fact, we want to jump in and say this was where the 1968 Orangeburg massacre occurred. State troopers shot and killed 3 black youths, wounded 27 others. So that's going to resonate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's still an incredibly fresh topic, even though it's been 40 years since. And it'd be impossible for it not to come up tonight. So the candidates are going to have to navigate that minefield a little bit when it comes to dealing with race. But it's also important for everyone to understand that the black voters in South Carolina, like most of the country, I'm sure, are not monolithic. All the candidates are vying for the endorsements of these influential state leaders, but that doesn't necessarily translate into ballots being cast on their behalf. So they're going to have to work individually and not just rely on the endorsements of black politicians.
Well, tell us about the polls there, Aaron. Today's Wall Street Journal shows Obama now essentially neck and neck with Hillary Clinton. John Edwards solidly in third place. So who is leading the polls in South Carolina?
It's essentially about the same. There's been a couple of recent polls that have come out just in the last week, and they all show essentially the same thing. Clinton in the lead, Obama breathing down her neck, and Edwards solidly in third place. So all three of those are well within range of winning in South Carolina, and the rest of the guys are at 3% or below.
How do you explain those low polling numbers for John Edwards? He was born in South Carolina.
Sure.
He represented North, but born in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Made half a dozen trips to South Carolina, and he won the 2004 South Carolina primary.
Right. I honestly believe that John Edwards is about where he needs to be at this point in the race. He's within striking distance, and there's a long time to go. Barack Obama has kind of taken some of that atmosphere of the new face, the exciting new face that John had in 2004. But we're a big NASCAR state down here, and I've been using this analogy for car racing a lot, that John Edwards needs to not necessarily be in the lead at this point in the race, but he needs to be in the lead lap. He needs to be able to draft off the leaders and stay within distance to be able to pass them toward the end. And he's running a really smart campaign, and he's got a great ground team here. I wouldn't, by any stretch of the imagination, write him off yet.
Yeah. Let's take a look at some of the issues. Who's resonating most with South Carolina Democrats on the issue of abortion, much in the news now, especially considering that South Carolina may become the first state to require women considering an abortion to view an ultrasound image of the fetus?
The Democrats are all going to be pretty much opposed to that bill, I would think. I can't imagine that there'd be a candidate that would step out of the pack and support something like that. I think that you would have to look toward a more conservative, moderate candidate like Bill Richardson to maybe distinguish himself from some of the rest of the folks on abortion. But I think as a whole, they're all going to be supportive of Roe v. Wade. They're all going to be supportive of abortion rights. And I can't imagine that any of them would support this bill, the ultrasound bill.
Have any of the candidates said anything about gun control? This is a delicate tightrope for many Democrats because they want to win the South to win the presidency, and they're being told by consultants, in fact, we're going to hear from one, to lay off gun control in order to do that. But then we have the aftermath of the Virginia Tech shooting, and their core voters might want to hear them say something about gun control.
Yeah, I know for a fact that Bill Richardson supports a lot of gun rights and is less sure of gun control than some of the other candidates. Senator Edwards also is more toward the middle of the pack when it comes to gun rights. He supports, as a Southerner, he grew up with that whole notion of what you're talking about, a strong belief in the right to bear arms and support of the Second Amendment. But that doesn't mean that he wouldn't support things like closing that loophole in Virginia that allowed that kid to be able to get his hands on those weapons. But it is a very fine line to walk in South Carolina. We are a very conservative state, even our Democrats. And, when you start talking about registering handguns or outlawing handguns, that's not going to fly here, even among Democrats.
Yeah. Aaron Goldscheinin, staff writer for the state newspaper in South Carolina. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I want to bring in now Democratic political strategist Steve Jarding. He's author of Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Jarding is not working with any current candidate, but he ran John Edwards' 2004 Political Action Committee. Steve, welcome back to the program.
It's always good to be on, Robin.
And I want to start with that topic of gun control, because you've made a passionate plea to Democrats through your book and in other ways to not make gun control an issue. You say Democrats need to wake up and realize that the gun rights culture is here, not going to go away. It's like NASCAR. So I want to ask you, even in the wake of Virginia Tech, you heard what we were just saying. Core constituents might want to hear at least some tightening of the rules. And we know that Virginia, for instance, is looking to tighten the loophole that Aaron mentioned that allowed a mentally ill young person to buy a gun.
Well, and I think they should close loopholes like that. But I think if they go much further, they really do miss really the reality of the culture. I mean, if you look at where America is at today, whether you like it or not, whether politicians want to admit it or not, and Democratic leaders for a long time didn't want to admit it, we've got 40% of all households in America, Robin, have a gun in it. The culture of gun ownership, of hunting, of recreational use of guns for target practice, whatever it is, it's very deep in this country. And it's not just in South Carolina, as Aaron said. It certainly is there, but it really permeates all 50 states at some level. The point of all that for these political figures, I don't think you'll see a lot of these presidential candidates waver too much. I think they have backed off strict gun laws in the last few years because what they saw was that this culture wasn't going anywhere, and we have to respect it. And I think most of these presidential candidates will echo that sentiment.
Well, that's Democratic political consultant Steve Jarding. It's pretty provocative. He says Democrats should put aside the battle over gun control to perhaps win the war, if you will, the presidency. We'll have more of his thoughts on that and his strategy for tonight's first debate among the contenders. Back after a quick break, Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now, and we're back with Democratic political consultant Steve Jarding, ahead of the Democratic presidential candidate's first face-to-face nationally televised debate on MSNBC tonight. Jarding ran John Edwards' Political Action Committee in 2004. He's credited with helping Jim Webb, a gun-owning former Republican, win a Senate seat in Virginia. And Steve Jarding, you made the point just a moment ago that Democrats have to get with the gun culture. I can hear people saying, put politics ahead of safety? And risk losing some of the core voters. Can a Democrat, even win South Carolina in 2008?
if they get right in the culture and they're not offensive to voters, it's NASCAR, it's hunting, it's these kind of cultural issues that people feel very, very strong about. If you're right and you embrace the culture, then I think you can get to other issues. And I think for a Democrat to win in South Carolina, you first have to be right on the cultural stuff. And then I think you may be able to get to, this is what's going on with the war that's wrong, this is what's going on in the economy, here are issues that affect you, bread and butter issues in South Carolina. You can break through on those. Jim Webb did in Virginia against George Allen, but he couldn't do it if he was wrong in the culture.
Well, we're hearing from listeners who say they agree with you, others who say that putting aside gun control is too big a price for Democrats to pay. But we're going to put aside gun control now and look at other issues. The candidate's talking now to conservative audience in South Carolina, to a national audience, speaking to the press. What do you think they have to do tonight?
Well, it's going to be difficult, unfortunately, and I think the way this is shaping up is as follows. You've got Hillary and Barack Obama that are winning the money race, and if I were advising either one of them, unfortunately, and just being strictly politically here, I would say don't make any mistakes. I mean, the old adage in this business is it's tough to win a debate, but you don't want to lose one. So it's very likely they're going to be very careful. They're not going to take too many shots. They also know that this is South Carolina. The first primary caucus, if you will, is in Iowa, much more liberal audience. So they're not going to want to pigeonhole themselves and try to pander to the South Carolina, one of those audiences that you talked about. They're not going to want to pander to that particular group.
We won't see Southern accents as we have at some of the past appearances, except for John Edwards, who that's how he speaks. But
I think that's right. And instead, what you're going to get is, I think Edwards is going to try to break out a little bit, and he'll try to, bring in his South Carolina roots and different things. But he's got to be careful, because while he wants to get into that first tier, if you will, he doesn't want to make a mistake either, because he's close. And then you've got this kind of third tier guys that are probably going to try to lob some bombs at the front runners. But my guess is the front runners aren't going to take the bait.
Well, the format makes it tough, because at 90 minutes, that means each candidate gets about 11. There's going to be software tracking how long they speak. Listeners could be hearing as much from Mike Gravel of Alaska as from Hillary Clinton. And some analysts are saying, yes, that does mean that the third tier candidates might have to lob some sort of attack on Hillary Clinton just to be noticed.
Right. I think that is likely to happen. But again, the format for these things isn't conducive to a real debate. It's more of a soundbite. It's more of a showcase where you talk in scripted sound bites, and that's how you train for these things. And it's unfortunate. It is too short. There's too many candidates to actually conduct a legitimate debate in this setting. And when you divide it with eight candidates, you may be talking at most probably 10 minutes. Unfortunately, I think what you're going to get, and by the way, I think you get this in part because of this front-loading of the primary system and this emphasis then on money. We're in the midst of our first primary right now, Rob, and it's the money one. And as we all know, on the report that came out after June 30th, Hillary and Obama basically won the money war. That's why they're considered the front runners. John Edwards came in second tier to those two, so he's considered maybe he can break into the top, and the rest of them are afterthoughts. Unfortunately, they're afterthoughts, and we haven't even heard from them.
Do you think that there is a chance of one of the candidates, Biden, Richardson, Kucinich, whomever, really seizing the moment, and what might it be that they, what would you advise that they say?
Well, I think there is a chance. Unfortunately, I think it's probably somewhat slim, but I do think there's a chance. My advice to anyone of this kind of third tier, and there's some really terrific people, and I mean, there's a fourth tier of individuals that have already gotten out, the Evan Bayh, the Mark Warner, the Tom Vilsacks. All three very bright people who could have added a lot to the debate. This third tier with Biden and Dodd and Richardson, all real good people in there. My advice to them would be one of these guys has to come forward and say, let's cut through, kind of the facade here, and let's look at what we need to do in America. I'm gonna be the straight talker. I'm gonna be the honest voice. I'm gonna come and say, here's what's going on in America, whether it's in the South, 6 out of 10 people have a high school degree or less. That's unconscionable in this country. We've got 20% of the kids in the South going to bed hungry. That won't happen when I'm president of the United States. We're gonna take care of that. Go down the litany of health insurance, of wages that are suppressed. If someone can come forth and say, I'm going to give you the tough medicine. Yes, it may take some pain. I'm going to ask you to sacrifice, but by God, that's what made us great. If one of these guys can do that and become kind of this, what McCain was in 2004, this individual who's honest, who's bringing us the tough medicine, who's telling us the truth. And while the other guys are being cautious, they look like politicians. Then I think one of these guys has a shot to break out.
I just have to say before we sign off, Steve, we've gotten through this whole conversation without mentioning Iraq. Is that in part because there's an assumption that Democrats are against the war and whether or not someone cast a vote years ago in a certain way doesn't matter?
Well, it may not be. I actually do sense, though, that there may be a little bit of this, particularly with some of the people, trying to take shots at Hillary. It's really been one of the only cracks in her armor in many ways, where other Democrats who have either John Edwards, who said, I made a mistake and Hillary should admit she made a mistake, or Barack Obama, who said, listen, I opposed this thing from the start. Obviously, he wasn't there for the vote. But you may see some of that come into play, because I think they're going to try to have separation. But again, if these guys want to attack her, if they want to, you know, that's risky in South Carolina, it may turn some South Carolinians against them, but I do think it's a possibility, because there really hasn't been much that they could go after the front runner Clinton on, and you may see some of these guys try to pin her down and try to make her look bad because she's refused to admit that that was a mistake.
Steve Jarding, Democratic political consultant and author of Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Steve, thanks as always.
Pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
And we'll be watching. Quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. Sari Nusseibeh, a descendant of one of the oldest Arab families, on the toll violence is taking on Palestinian society and the need to reconcile with Israel. That's tomorrow. But still ahead, remember that incredible report we heard of thousands of injured Iraq War vets denied benefits and told they had pre-existing conditions? Well, we're going to have an update on that. You want to hear that. That's after the news, Here and Now.
Support for him.
It's Here and Now, and we want to spend a few minutes now updating a story from earlier this month. We spoke then with reporter Joshua Kors, who investigated claims that thousands of injured troops had been discharged from the military without benefit because they were diagnosed as having pre-existing personality disorders. Kors concluded that this was a way for the military to cut costs because the Department of Veterans Affairs doesn't have to provide care or disability pay to soldiers whose wartime disabilities are attributed to pre-existing disorders that somehow went undetected when they enlisted. It's called Regulation 635-200, Chapter 5-13, Separation Because of Personality Disorder. And Joshua Kors joins us again with an update. Joshua, welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin.
A lot of reaction to your story.
Yes, quite a lot, not just from the public, but also from a host of senators who has since written a letter to the GAO asking for an investigation.
That's the General Accounting Office. We want to hear more about that. But first, for those who didn't hear your story, your original article focused on Army Specialist John Towne, injured in Iraq. In fact, he won a Purple Heart. He lost his hearing after shrapnel lodged in his neck after a rocket exploded. The Army actually claimed that that disability, the loss of hearing, was caused by a pre-existing personality disorder. Now, you went on to research and find that this was happening to thousands of soldiers, the Army saving billions of dollars. But first of all, what is the status of John Towne's case today?
The VA spent 8 months deciding they were not going to give him disability and medical care for the rest of his life. Then just the other day, they completely reversed course, rushed him down to the Dayton, Ohio VA, and are now giving him full medical treatment.
Now, we understand that some of the information about this case is off the record, but what can you tell us about why this was reversed?
Well, I understand that they received contact from a top government official who demanded that they take action, knowing that this was a PR situation that was rapidly blowing up in their face.
Well, as you said, a group of senators is now calling for the General Accounting Office to investigate not just John Towne's case, but others at Fort Carson. Tell us about that.
I think this action has to be seen in the light of tonight's Democratic debate. Senator Barack Obama, Barbara Boxer, and others have sent a letter saying that this personality disorder scandal needs to be investigated.
They called it a scandal.
That's not the language they used, but they clearly recognize it as a very serious issue. Not just personality disorder, but also this accusation that those seeking treatment for physical and mental wounds are somehow faking it. That was the case in John Towne's case. His medical records has documentation saying that he is faking his hearing loss. That obviously is going to discourage any soldiers from going to seek treatment. And it means that the military basically has an open and shut case against all these soldiers seeking compensation for their wounds.
NPR's Daniel Zwerdling, we want to say, also did some terrific reporting on the lack of awareness of post-traumatic stress syndrome. We understand a portion of the letter that senators wrote to the GAO says, we've heard of cases in which service members with PTSD are diagnosed as having pre-existing personality disorders. And the letter went on to ask that there be investigations. What are senators demanding be investigated?
The way in which these soldiers are discharged, and also the appropriateness of those discharges. As you know, discharging a soldier with pre-existing conditions means they can never receive disability or medical pay for the rest of their life. And also, one of the small print items is that they have to give back their signing bonus so that thousands of these wounded soldiers find out on their final day in uniform they owe thousands of dollars to the Army. And Robin, I should say, it's not just these senators that are seeking investigation. There's also been pressure on the Surgeon General's office to take action, but they have been furiously spinning their wheels trying to cover up their action.
Well, let's talk about that. The Surgeon General's office said they did review some of the cases and found they were diagnosed correctly. Now, you have been questioning the Surgeon General on this review. What have you found?
The Surgeon General got to me a memo saying that they'd reviewed John Towne's case and a stack of others. They decided that after a 5-month thoughtful and thorough review, as they phrased it, that each of these cases were correctly diagnosed. I got a memo from Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tallman, spokesman for the Army, that went even further, saying that they had reviewed cases from the last 4 years at Fort Carson, where Specialist Towne was based, and decided that all of those cases were properly diagnosed. But I did a touch more reporting and found out that the Surgeon General's 5-month review was actually a sham. They didn't interview a single soldier in those 5 months. What they did do was go back to the doctor's offices where these false diagnoses were originally made and ask those offices to review themselves. They came back to the Surgeon General, said, yep, we got it right the first time, and they considered that a thoughtful and thorough review.
It does sound unbelievable, and I know you spoke again to the Surgeon General's office this week. What are they saying?
Tallman told me that he didn't really know how they could call it a thoughtful and thorough review, and he said, let me go one step further. I didn't write this memo, and I have no knowledge of its contents. He told me who did write the memo, Cynthia Vaughn, the public relations director for the Surgeon General's office. Today I placed my 17th phone call to her. She has yet given an answer as to how this investigation was proper.
Well, we know you've also been in touch with Congressman Bob Filner of California. He's a member of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. The Health Care Subcommittee of the House Veterans Affairs Committee is holding a hearing today on some of these issues. What will come of that?
That's right. They're looking into soldiers who are struggling with traumatic brain injury. That was the case with John Towne, who was struck by a rocket. Filner was very interested and spoke with great interest about having these soldiers testify. I think that's the thing that everyone who's been looking into this situation wants, for the soldiers to be able to testify in open session of Congress on camera in front of the American people. But right now, it's going to take a lot more pressure from the public, them demanding that this occur, for it to actually come to be.
Reporter Joshua Kors, we mentioned that the soldier that you focused on, Mr. Towne, had his denial of benefits reversed. But you wrote in your article that there were thousands of soldiers who'd had this. Have you any sense that any other denials have been reversed?
No, not at all. Yet 22,500 soldiers have been discharged with this personality disorder provision in the last 6 years. And I should clarify about John's case. They are now giving him medical treatment, but they did not reverse his personality disorder diagnosis and discharge. Mm-hmm. And that means he's still not getting any disability pay.
Reporter Joshua Kors, he's been following the story of wounded Iraq War veterans who've lost their medical benefits and disability pay because they are then diagnosed with pre-existing personality disorders that somehow were not noticed when they first enlisted. His original story appeared in The Nation magazine. Joshua, thanks so much for updating us.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, for a link to Josh's reporting in The Nation or our conversation from a few weeks ago, to go to our website, here-now.org. Still to come, the music of the New Orleans Jazz Fest. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, just how long will A-Rod's hot streak last? Who will go first in the NFL draft? And will the relaunch of women's soccer meet with success? To shed light on these questions, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us as he does almost every week. Bill, always good to see you.
Good to see you again, Robin, and the answer to the third question is yes.
Okay, we'll get to that. Yes. We'll get to that, but come on, what's the most important topic? The Red Sox suck. We have to talk about this. Last night, the Red Sox walloped the Orioles 6-1 behind the pitching of Curt Schilling. But in the fifth inning, Gary Thorne, who does play-by-play for the Orioles, turned to his broadcast partner Jim Palmer and said on the air that he had been told by Sox catcher Doug Mirabelli that it was paint, not blood, on Curt Schilling's sock during Game 6 of the 2004 American League Championship Series against the Yankees, the sock that the cameras focused on, the heroic efforts of the noble Curt Schilling, as bloody but unbowed, he pitched that game. Are we being told that this was not a bloody ankle?
Robin, this is why we have DNA testing. And the sock is, of course, at the Hall of Fame
in
Cooperstown, New York, and they will test it. And I hope they don't find that Curt Schilling's veins run with red paint and that red paint is, in fact, a performance-enhancing substance, because we would be in terrible trouble then, and children would be weeping throughout the Commonwealth.
Well, now, what does Doug Mirabelli say? Did he tell Thorne
this? Doug Mirabelli says Gary Thorne is a liar. The issue here really is, what does Gary Thorne have to gain by saying this? The last thing that a play-by-play guy wants is notoriety. They really wish to be the wallpaper of summer. They don't want to be in the news. So I'm not sure what Thorne really would have to gain by making this story up. But I will await the DNA results.
Well, thank you very much and goodbye. Oh, wait, there's other things to talk about. The Red Sox head to New York. The Yankees rained out in Tampa Bay last night. Rain, the only thing, by the way, that might put a damper on A-Rod. This is the Yankee third baseman, Alex Rodriguez, if you haven't, for some reason, been inundated with this information, who is just on a streak.
Yeah, 119 home runs he will hit if he stays on his current pace, which is about as likely as my hitting 119 home runs this year, but that's all right. It is terrifically ironic because last year Yankee fans were calling him a psycho and a head case and saying we got to get rid of this guy. And this year, of course, they're worried that at the end of this year, when he will have the opportunity to change teams if he wishes to do so, that he will do so and take his 119 home runs a year with him.
right. Hello, up here. Well, Bill, the NFL holds its draft this weekend, and it feels as if a couple of quarterbacks are going to get scooped up fast. The only question is who will go first, and they're sort of dueling this out. Jamarcus Russell from Louisiana State University and Notre Dame's Brady Quinn are waging kind of an off-field duel.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more.
Never, never, never bet against a quarterback named Brady, especially when his last name is Quinn, because you'll not see nothing like the mighty Quinn.
So you think he's going to be
first?
This
is my Bob Dylan reference for today.
That's what it was.
I think he should be first.
I think
if the people making the picks are Bob Dylan fans, he will be first. Or Patriots fans, because his first name is Brady.
It's Brady. Well, something we know you've been watching, and we cannot let you go without noting this. The effort to revive professional women's soccer got a boost this week when ownership groups from Boston and the New York area agreed to field teams for a resurgence of the Women's United Soccer Association. You were in mourning when the WSA went
under. I am thrilled to see this is happening. I'm even more thrilled that Christine Lilly, age 36, has said that she will play in Boston, and that more and more people will have a chance to see great younger players like Abby Wambach, who may be the greatest offensive player I've ever seen in women's soccer. It should be great fun.
Okay, and they may start up a year from now. Okay, in the minute we have left, it's not fair, but either way, it's not fair, the time or that it happened. David Halberstam killed this week in a car accident on his way to do an interview for a book about the epic 1958 NFL Colts Giants championship game. Such a loss.
A tremendous loss, although some real irony in the fact that so many people from the world of sports are talking about the loss. It is, of course. He was a fine writer about many games. But this is a man who, less than a year ago, said at a journalism symposium, the crueler the war gets, the crueler the attacks get on anybody who doesn't salute or play the game. He really should be remembered mostly as a great writer about things like the Vietnam War, a Pulitzer Prize winner in that context.
There you go. Bill Littlefield covering sports and so much more every weekend on his NPR program, Only a Game. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. The music of New Orleans is straight ahead, here and now. Here and now. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival begins tomorrow, only the second staging of the event since Hurricane Katrina. What locals call Jazz Fest began in 1970. It's always on the last weekend of April and first weekend of May. Some of the acts this year are local favorites like Snooks Eaglin, Kermit Ruffins, and the Iguanas, and headliners like ZZ Top, Counting Crows, John Mayer, and Rod Stewart. Wait, Rod Stewart? Mr. Maggie May himself? You call that a jazz festival? Well, critics say that what was once a haven for lovers of indigenous New Orleans and Louisiana music, jazz, blues, gospel, Cajun, and R&B, has sold out. But here now, jazz aficionado James Isaac says you can still find the real deal, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Merci, Robin.
What are we listening to?
Robin, what we're listening to is the infectious sound of Bourbon Street Parade, or as they say down in the Crescent City, Bourbon Street Parade. And that's from Harry Connick Jr.'s new disc, Chanson du Vieux Carré, one of two new New Orleans tribute albums he's recently released. Good stuff.
He's been very public about his support of his city.
Sure has.
I was just remembering that one of my first images was of him getting a sort of a rowboat and getting into the city before any, you know, any of the government officials were there. And I kept screaming, if Harry Connick can get in, where's everybody else?
He stepped up because Harry's public appeals on behalf of his city and his music since then remind us that the life-changing music of New Orleans is one of the biggest aspects of that city's daily life, you know. This year's New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival offers a cornucopia of great music from all kinds of superb singers and players. I should say, Robin, yes, it is now a big tent event. There are rock and roll bands, there are pop singers, et cetera, because they want to make this thing as big and as profitable as possible, I guess, because there are a lot of people down there who need help.
Okay, fine. But we want to hear from you what you think people should particularly listen to. Harry Connick Jr., as you said, new CD, Chanson du Vieux Carré.
Very good.
And what's the second
one? Second one is Oh My NOLA. NOLA being an acronym for New Orleans, Louisiana. You probably knew that. Now, on that album, he doesn't sing. Okay. On Oh My NOLA, which is on Columbia, he does sing. Both discs are by Connick's big band. He arranged everything, composed some things, and he conducted. But the common thread is the music of his native New Orleans. And since Katrina, Harry Connick Jr. and other prominent New Orleans musicians have done so much to raise money to help those who lost everything. So hats off to all of them.
Well, you know, some people, though, you know, have criticized him as slick musically. Your thought?
Well, yeah, to tell you the truth, sometimes he does come on as slick. First of all, he's a very good-looking guy. Second, he's tremendously ambitious musically. He was a child prodigy in New Orleans. Harry Connick is a pianist, a vocalist, a composer, an arranger. His record company has tried, with some success, well, more than a little success, obviously, to link him to the young Sinatra. People say, he's a lounge singer. He's not. Harry Connick is in the big room of the Vegas hotels or whatever. He wanted to be there. But this I can say without reservation. Harry Connick can play the you-know-what out of the piano.
We've been listening to something from Harry Connick's new CD, Oh My NOLA. What is this?
This is his take on the 1966 hit for the late Lee Dorsey, who is also from New Orleans. It was co-written by Dorsey and the great Alain Toussaint, one of the supreme songwriters of the past 50 years and one of Harry Connick's musical heroes. This is the one called Working in the Coal Mine, Harry Connick Jr. and his orchestra working.
Harry Harry Connick Jr. for one of two new CDs of his. Well, James, you just mentioned Alan Toussaint. He'll also be at the New Orleans Festival this year.
He will indeed, Robin. And Alan Toussaint really is one of the giants of New Orleans music and of modern songwriting, really. I could go on for quite a while citing the songs he's written or co-written, but I'm just going to name five for you. Mother-in-Law.
Mother-in-Law. Mother-in-Law.
Ruler of My Heart, also known as Pain in My Heart.
Ruler of My Heart.
Southern Nights.
Southern Nights.
Sneaking Sally Through the Alley.
Sneaking Sally Through the Alley.
And Yes, We Can, Can.
I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know darn well.
Believe me, there are many more outstanding songs in the Toussaint songbook. He's also a brilliant pianist, a multi-hit-making record producer, and a vocalist, although he's always been very modest about his own singing.
And there was a moment, too, I'm remembering back, where people didn't know where he was during Katrina, a very frightening moment. Well, he's also made some noise with a collaboration with Elvis Costello last year. This is The River in Reverse.
They toured behind it, they were on TV with it, and it's a very good record.
Let's hear something from that.
Okay, this is the one called Nearer to You, a Ballad of Beauty.
I know you said that you'll be home soon. I got to be nearer, nearer to you.
Elvis Costello singing Alan Toussaint's Nearer to You. Let's keep going with more from some of the Toussaint songbook.
Robin, I just mentioned Yes, We Can, Can, which perhaps you and our listeners remember from the Pointer Sisters' 1973 version. Mm. So we've got Toussaint from a non-such disc called Our New Orleans, a benefit album, Alan Toussaint on his own, singing and playing.
And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know darn well we can work it out. If we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can, can. Yes, we can. Great gosh almighty. Yes, we can. I know we can, can.
Alan Toussaint, one of the most important musical figures, would you say, to come out of New Orleans?
Unquestionably.
Right. Now, finally, it wouldn't be New Orleans Jazz Fest without some brass band sounds. What have we got?
Robin, it's the Rebirth Brass Band, and back in the 1980s, they were young men who helped reestablish one of the vital sounds of the Crescent City, that of the brass band. Now, they're not exactly elder statesmen at this point, but they've been celebrated for a while. Gospel is a big part of the New Orleans musical experience, and it's also part of the Rebirth repertoire. So I thought we'd take it home with Rebirth's rendition of the spiritual called Just a Little While to Stay Here, the Rebirth Brass Band, and this is from their disc on Rounder called Roland. Listen to that snare drum. God, just knocks your socks off.
That's the Rebirth Brass Band, appropriately named for what some hope is a rebirth, a continuing rebirth of the city of New Orleans.
Absolument. There you go.
The song is Just a Little While to Stay Here. James Isaacs, our New Orleans jazz, blues, rock and roll, gospel, and brass band aficionado. Thank you for this all-too-brief trip to the Crescent City. But, you know, people can head on down to the Jazz Fest if they want more.
They sure can. Laissez le bon temps rouler, Robin.
Back at it. For more on the music you heard and for a schedule of the Jazz Festival, go to our website, here-now.org. And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.